welcome back to Sermon Notes. Sermon Notes back from vacation last week. So we are back this week. We are looking at Acts 24. Andy, if you were here on Sunday, also walked us through how we get to chapter 24. And so, you know, Paul's going to be essentially bound, arrested, and standing really a religious trial. And that's going to now turn into a series of hearings, a series of, you know, we can call them trials, but they're really just, they're kind of public hearings. And that's where we find ourselves in Acts 24. This week, teaching in Sunday morning will be Jacob Bookout. And so he's on our college team. So Jacob, give us the kind of the lay of the land on the passage. What happens? You know, what's going on? And then we'll dive into some of the details.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, Andy left off in a great spot to just pick it right up where it continues to go, which is that the guards, centurions that pulled Paul out of the chaotic mob that was trying to kill him, gives him an escort, a really impressive escort, actually, to Caesarea, where Felix, who's like the presiding governor over the region, is in accordance with Roman jurisdiction law. Like they have to take him down there because he is he's a Roman citizen. Mm-hmm. They couldn't just, you know, rough him up a little bit in order to get answers like they were planning on doing. And yet, like you said, this is very much like a legal trial. And specifically in chapter 24, which we'll play with a little bit on Sunday morning, but we're not going to dive into like the full ramifications of it. So it's probably good to talk about it here. There's a lot of like very technical legal things going on in chapter 24.
It's good that your wife's a lawyer.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm sure y'all processed this, you know, laying in bed at night and just talking about the Bible and the legalese. I'm sure that was delightful to her.
Yes, whenever I told her which one I was reading through and like what I was working on, she like immediately jumped in and was like,
oh, legalese, this is amazing.
Yeah. So all the attorneys out there, we'll talk about it a little bit.
Great sermon for you.
Yeah. But specifically 24, like you said, there's multiple hearings, right? 24 is seemingly the most technical in how it gets laid out to show just how like significant of hearings this is. Again, it's not just like the Romans and the authorities like trying to figure out what's going on with Paul. Like they're following very specific procedure. And Paul makes this defense. He's defending himself for like multiple chapters in this section that we're in. He makes his defense in alignment with like a very official way that you'd go about doing it in a court setting. So similarly to if you were to go to the federal court here in Fayetteville and sit in on any type of trial, whether it's a jury trial or something that
we're all itching to do that, aren't we?
Yeah.
Everybody loves jury duty.
Yeah, exactly. There's gonna be a specific format and Paul follows that format. And so basically what you have is you have some of the Sanhedrin and they've hired this lawyer, basically, Tertullus, and he's the one that's presenting the case before Felix. Now, one of the things that's interesting, and Paul makes a note of it in kind of the second section in this chapter where he's defending himself, is that the Jews from Asia Minor, who have been the ones that are just like wreaking havoc in his life for a very long time at this point.
Years now.
Yeah, years now. They are the ones that whenever he was in the temple and he'd gone through the purification ceremonies, and you can see this in chapter 21, they're the ones that are like, look, it's Paul. And they cause like this big disturbance and riot and they pull him out. And it says that they started claiming like he desecrated the temple because he brought a Gentile in there. And Luke gives us a little parenthetical statement that they just assumed that, but that actually didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyways, they bring all of this charge against Paul, but they're not here in this trial. They're seemingly probably still up in Jerusalem. That's really significant because according to just like how the Roman law was practiced, the people who bring the charge, it is a very bad deal for them to not be there in defense. And so the fact that it's just the Jewish leadership of the Sanhedrin and they've, you know, hired this attorney to make his case beforehand, that already puts them in a pretty weak place. And Paul like very much hones in on that whenever he makes his defenses. Whenever we see the charge be brought against him by Tertullus, I think it's kind of funny, but he goes into this like long statement at the very beginning, like basically praising Felix, which was a very common thing to do. I can't remember the exact term for it, but there's a specific term where you basically like honor the judge, basically, but he like really like pours the sugar on it. Like he's like really trying to win.
And we should note Felix was no angel. I mean, he was, I mean, widely regarded inside Israel and outside Israel as an absolutely terrible, corrupt, cruel, incompetent. In fact, he'll get recalled by Nero. Like when Nero thinks you stink at your job, you're so crazy and incompetent and corrupt. When that's Nero saying that, you're probably pretty bad. Yeah. And so, he's really buttering him up here, even though he probably doesn't believe it at all.
Yeah. He's absolutely buttering him up. And you actually see a lot of what you just said at the end of the chapter, because it says that, so he ends up keeping Paul there for 2 years and he keeps bringing him back and bringing him back. And it says that he does that because he wants to appease the Jews. So he doesn't want to like for them to keep rioting. So he's trying to maintain that political element. But he's also like, he hoped that Paul would give him a bribe. So he just keeps bringing him back. You can give me any money yet?
He heard any money yet? Paul, one of Paul's defenses. And then it's funny because Paul's defense is, I came here to help the Jews by bringing this big collection of money. And I think he hears money. He's like, oh, money. You got money? So yeah, 2 years, he's like, give me that cash, man. Totally. So yeah, exactly.
And what's even, I think what's the most interesting in that element at the very end of this, which like just completely skipping ahead, but his wife, Drusilla, she's a Jew, and he basically stole her from another guy. And whenever the first time that Felix brings Paul before him and his wife, it actually seems like it's his wife more so that was like wanting to inquire about the Christian faith because she's Jewish. And Felix just was like, all right, let's do this. And then Paul starts, he says, he tells him about the faith and he preaches like righteousness to him and
self-control.
So all these things that he's known for not being, and then he gets uncomfortable and sends him away.
Yeah, I don't like this anymore.
So Felix is not a good dude. And he gets buttered up by Tertullus, this attorney, for a long time. And then he brings these charges where he says, let's see, which chapter is this? Or which verse? It says in verse 5, we have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple. So we seized him. By examining him yourself, you'll be able to learn the truth about all these charges that we're bringing against him. And so those are kind of like the three charges that gets brought against him. And Paul, in his response, he follows the exact same format. He also participates in the honoring the judge statement, except he does it like from a genuine place of like Christian honor. He does not butter him up. He does not say anything more than he ought. He simply says, I know that for a number of years, you have been judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense.
Yeah.
He just like states the facts. You've been here for a long time, I'll make my defense to you.
You're here. I guess I'll say that. Yeah. That's all I could probably say about you.
Which again, I think those two statements are so funny. But then he goes through and he just like kind of line by line follows the charges with defenses. And he basically is like, yeah, like I'll tell you exactly the truth of it, and describes how, why he went there. So he went to Jerusalem to bring the gifts for the church. And he says the accusers, which he goes on to say, who by the way, aren't even here. They didn't find me arguing with anybody in the temple, stirring up a crowd, anything like that. They can't prove any of these charges. But in this first section of his defense, basically, there's three charges against him. That the middle one, the second one that Tertullus brings, is that he's a ringleader of the Nazarene sect, which is very like derogatory. That's a negative statement. Like he's like stirring up trouble. It's just a sect, like blah, blah, blah. But Paul actually says, I will own up to that one. Yeah. Like I do follow the way, which they call a sect of Judaism, like a heretical sect, basically. But then he goes on to describe, he like takes this opportunity in this court setting before Felix. He's not even done making his defenses. Like he just stops at this one and describes how I am a part of this, but it's not what they're claiming it to be. And he goes on to talk about how he actually shares the same faith as these Jews who are bringing this charge against him, because he sees Jesus as the fulfillment of all these things, that he follows the law and the prophets. And then Andy brought this up this past week for just a brief moment towards the beginning, but twice he hits hard on the fact that this faith that he's talking about, that he says the Jews share, is that there's a hope of the resurrection of the dead, both of the righteous and the unrighteous.
That's going to be in all his speeches. He'll do that in every one of them. He'll talk about this hope, the hope. He says different things around it, but the hope in the resurrection. Yeah. This is going to be real central over the next few weeks. So anyway, keep going.
Yeah. And that's actually what we're going to hit on like a ton on Sunday morning in the sermon. So we won't have to dive into it necessarily super heavily. But yeah, that's like his, that's like the center point to his defense in this chapter. And it is also kind of the central statement that he continues to make, like you said, in all of these defenses. And so you have him go basically through this responding to the charges, making his defenses. And he basically just says the same thing, a couple different ways, responding to each charge. Hey, here's what actually happened. I was in the temple. I was not desecrating it. I wasn't arguing with anybody. They're the ones that came in and stirred this whole thing up. They're not even here. And that's kind of his mic drop. He says that, hey, these people that are bringing charges against me are not even here. And he knows the way that this works and that is actually like a very, harsh statement against them. And it says that in verse 22, Felix, who was well acquainted with the way. So in some capacity, Felix had some type of understanding about this Jewish sect called the way. Maybe it was because Drusilla was a Jew and she was like getting really interested in it, or just because he's presiding over the region where all of this is starting. And for whatever reason, he understands it enough to know that what Paul is claiming, seemingly he's accepting it as like true. He's like, okay, yeah, like I understand what the Jews think about this sect and that there's not really any grounds for it. And so he says that whenever he does decide his case, he doesn't decide it immediately there until that point, to keep Paul under guard and give him some of this, to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of him. So he basically, going back to seemingly his poor moral standard, is that he recognizes that Paul is innocent, but he's unwilling to rule innocent because he doesn't want the Jews to cause an uproar on this again. And so he keeps them technically held in captivity, but he allows them a lot more freedoms to have people come visit him. He's bringing them in to talk to him a lot. And seemingly it's because he is just trying to get like a bribe out of him in some way. And so you basically have that be, as far as his engagement with Felix, that's kind of like Paul's end. Like he keeps bringing him in. I would imagine Paul, he does for sure that first time that he brings him in, but I imagine he would continue talking about the faith, or at least trying to, over the course of 2 years as he keeps bringing him in some capacity. But then it says at the very end of the chapter that when 2 years has passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. And because Felix wanted to grant favor to the Jews, he had left Paul in prison. And so then it picks up after that. But overall, these like very technical, it's just interesting that Luke provides this very technical account of the way the legal setting, or the way that the legal process went, and how that setting is what Paul, again, we're seeing Paul like adapt to his circumstances in just super brilliant ways, because he knows this is how this process is supposed to go. And in his rhetoric, he matches that, but he drops the resurrection and he's like, this is the thing that I will die on. And my hope is in the resurrection. And he also kind of brings the, hey, the guys aren't even here to be able to bring these charges against me, which is actually like incredibly defeating to that argument. So much so that like Felix just ends it there. Like there's not even, it just ends basically. And he's like, I don't need to hear anymore. So it's very short, which that's also something that's pretty foreign to our legal process, especially being married to an attorney. There's nothing short about any legal process in our country. Yeah.
Paperwork and weeks of prep and
So this is just, he gets brought before it. But yeah, that legal setting, this seemingly is the most prominent as far as like seeing the ins and outs of like how this, the legal jurisdiction's going, which is interesting, and it will set the tone for the sermon. But we're going to dive into a lot more as to, okay, why does Paul do the things that he did leading him to this situation that he's defending? And it's all because of the hope, like what he believes about the resurrection, that it's influencing everything about how he lives and how he addresses people and how he talks, both with tact, but also with boldness and bluntness oftentimes, like you see him in this, at the end of this section. So
what is unsaid, that you're not going to have time in the sermon, or as you were prepping it, you were like, man, this is important, or this is interesting, but just, I can't get it in there. Anything that that stands out to you? I mean, we could talk about obviously these people where they're at. This is all, you mentioned Caesarea by the Sea, which is where this is taking place. I'll show an image of it here in a few weeks when I'm up again. It was a pretty lavish. Like Felix is living it up down there, and so he the setting for even where this is taking place is not. It's interesting, perhaps. How does Felix know? Well, this is where Philip had come and presumably launched this church with the centurion in back in chapter 8. And so Paul had spent some time there when he was going up to Jerusalem. So perhaps that centurion is associated with, it's not a big place, Caesarea by the Sea. So there's probably a little house church movement that's been simmering right under Felix's nose. And as you kind of connect the dots through Acts, you can see like, that's why, he probably has heard some things about it because it's happening all around him. Mm-hmm. Okay, anything that doesn't make the cut?
Something, we'll briefly mention it, but not dive super into it. The fact that Paul brings up this hope of the resurrection, this is the very same thing that Andy talked about, like throwing the grenade into the middle of the meeting where you have the Pharisees and the Sadducees there, because the Pharisees are, they're like, yes, there is a resurrection of the dead. The Sadducees, which is another section of Jewish thought and leadership, they deny that there's any type of resurrection of the dead. And something that's interesting about part of the reason, seemingly, that they deny that, which is attached to what you're talking about with Felix, and he's like living it up in Caesarea, is that over the course of kind of like where the Sadducees came from and their like history and kind of like the political involvement that they've had, they have pretty good reason actually to deny the resurrection of the dead for the sake of maintaining a type of like status and influence within the like broader, not just the Jewish community, but within the Roman Empire that they exist in. Because one of the reasons is because, well, if there is no resurrection of the dead, then ultimately the only thing that does matter is experienced life right now. And that is a powerful leverage point over people, especially whenever you're in some type of like religious authority. And that getting paired up with something like a Felix who has been instated by Rome, and you know, Rome's pampering him because they're the Roman Empire. There's a collusion of some power elements going on. Not that the Pharisees did not have powerful positions by any means, but the Sadducees, especially being known for being seen oftentimes by the other groups of Jews as maybe a little too buddy-buddy with the emperor, that is an element about this idea of the hope of the resurrection of the dead. Both Jesus being the first fruits, as Paul talks about it in 1 Corinthians, he is the first one that is to be raised from the dead because he has been raised from the dead, right? So he's the one that kicks off this resurrection that happens. But the resurrection that especially Paul's alluding to is that there will be this resurrection of the righteous and the unrighteous. So this is we're ushering in new heavens, new earth. Like Jesus is fulfilling all things. When we think about like the very end of the age, if you will. And the very beginning of that is going to be a judgment of people. Were you righteous? Were you unrighteous? Were you in Christ or were you not in Christ? And that ushers us into full kind of like the eternal life element of the resurrection. And that is a hope that you actually, seemingly, you see one of the reasons why in the very earliest part of the church, so many of the people that were responding to the Christian faith were the people who, they didn't have anything in the current existence in life. They were like the poor and the marginalized and the fringe, and they're the ones that needed help. You would have powerful people, you know, have some rich men and women, you'd have centurions, people like that, but they're actually the minority for the first, you know, 100, 150 years of the church. And I think a lot of it is wrapped up in this idea that whenever Jesus promises life to those who are spiritually poor, like he talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, everything is rooted in the resurrection and what that promise is. And whenever you have the too closeness or the collusion of what current reality can give us, which is often toward or often through what we normally think about as like power, fame, status, monetary ability, things like that, it actually strips away the power of that hope of the resurrection of the dead, because our hope starts to just be in what we can exist in now. And that seemingly had a lot to play in some of this, it's not everything by any means, but there's an element of that with the Sadducees' denial of the resurrection of the dead over the course of time. And even whenever the gospel starts to interact with Rome and Greek culture, there's different ideas about the afterlife and even like, you know, resurrection elements and stuff like that. And one of the things that is consistently common is that whenever it does butt up against the thing that strips it of its power, which is, well, we have what we need right here. It's like, well, I'm too focused on right here to think about what's to come. That becomes one of the biggest problems in, I mean, it has been even before this, but even for us, like as Christians, that does become one of the biggest problems. And there's a lot of specific subcultural elements, whether you be a Sadducee or somebody like in Felix's position, or you're, a wealthy Roman person who's in Asia Minor, or like we were talking about just a little bit ago, as the church starts to grow and it eventually becomes imperial and you have like Constantine, for example, it's like, well, it's a huge shift because now Christianity has the power of the world behind it from an empire standpoint. So how does that affect how we think about this hope of the resurrection that we have? And so there's, again, we're going to unpack a lot of this hope of the resurrection, but that specific like power element dynamic and how it even leads people to think about the resurrection of the dead is something that's really interesting in these little subcultures that we won't really talk about that much.
You know, one of the questions to ask, and we'll be doing this in this podcast going forward, I'm sure, is, you know, why tell this story? You know, why include these little hearings? And I think it is a, you know, what is Luke's intention? Why, especially they get pretty repetitive, you know? And so I do think one of the things that Luke is trying to do is shape a readership, shape his audience, who are largely trying to go figure out how to live for Christ in the Roman world. Like, hey, every time we were on trial, we were good and we were polite and we aren't doing that thing. And hey, every time we were on trial, the Roman leaders, the book of Acts doesn't come out right and just like slam them. There's a way to say it a lot worse, but they always look, there's a little bit of buffoonery almost always. Mm. And so I do think that one of the things these chapters will do is I think is calling the reader to go, this is how we're going to go out there and live in the buffoonery of the Roman Empire. And we got a better thing actually. And so Felix looks the part. He's got the palace, he's got all the, and yet he seems like an idiot. He's corrupt. Paul has nothing. And yet he knows the legal system. He's smarter. Like it's instructive for us, I think, in reading this, like go out and be like this and see through the buffoonery. And so there's plenty of buffoonery, by the way, on every side. So don't hear that as me calling out any particular buffoonery. I'm talking about it on all sides. Mm-hmm. And so we, I think, are to have lenses to see through some of that. We'll unpack that, I know, more as we go. But anything else that stands out as we close it down?
I don't think there's anything else specific. Like I said, we're going to dive into a lot of unpacking, like what is the doctrine of the resurrection? And we're going to unpack it with in regards to Jesus in the, like whenever we think about the resurrection, we think about Jesus, right? And he's the first fruits, but it's the first part of this big thing that he's launching basically. And that Paul talks about again in Corinthians that this is seemingly the most important belief and doctrine of Christianity because everything kind of hinges on it. And then seeing how that is dictating why Paul's acting like you just said. He's polite. And it's not just not politeness, but he's thinking through how does Jesus go through all this? Like think about Jesus's trials. We get a ton of Jesus's trials, right? And the way that Jesus goes through it is standing on what is true and is very bold and yet is not dishonoring in any way. And he takes what he obviously is willing to take for the sake of us. And Paul is just following that model to a T. And so, yeah, that's what we're going to dive into on Sunday.
If you like legalese, then this is your Sunday to be at church. So we look forward to it. As always, thank you for listening to Sermon Notes and have a great week.